Hello, my name is Simon Ward, and I would like to welcome you to the Triathlon Coach podcast. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic champions and covering all distances from sprint to Ironman. Now it's my goal in this weekly 30-minute podcast to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. So as I've already said, we've got just 30 minutes, so let's get rolling with today's guest. We are back with the White Witch herself, Louise Edmondson.
Hello.
And we are going to carry on the conversation we had last week. So if you haven't listened to that episode yet, I strongly suggest that you do, because it will give you the foundation for what we're going to talk about now. And here's a quick summary. In the previous episode, we talked about Louise's approach to bike fitting. No gadgets or gizmos or digital red dots or any of that. Just Louise's practiced eye and an understanding of how the body of that individual works and is working in relation to cycling. The assessment process that Louise goes through is 50% related to full top-to-toe assessment of medical history and the way the body moves, and then 50% devoted to having the rider sat on the bike. And when the person walks out of the studio after 2.5 hours, they get a bike fit that is ready for them to use in the physical condition that they are at that particular moment. They also get this full 4, 5, 6 page report of the assessment, indicating some of the limiters to movement and also and to future potential, but also suggestions as to exercise they can do to alter this. Now, we discussed at the end of the last podcast that bike fit, even though we know it's the most aerodynamic position that person can attain, still isn't the finished article, is it?
Nope.
It requires some effort on behalf of the rider now to be able to make the most from that bike position. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Yep. So you mentioned, Louisa, that in the report, it highlights some of the weaknesses. So let's start at the top of a, you know, an imaginary rider. They're going to be perched on, we're talking about triathletes, so they're going to be perched on a time trial bike on aero bars.
Yep.
So what might tightness around the shoulders or the pectorals or weakness around the shoulder blades, what impact might that have on ability to hold an aero position for the duration of the ride they're doing?
Yep, quite a bit. There's obviously the fatigue. If you've just swum as well, your shoulder's going to be a bit fatigued to then get on the bike and hold that aero position. If you're not strong enough around the shoulders, you may then have less control over your bike. So if it's very windy or a very technical course, you won't have as great a control over that. It will affect how you breathe. If your shoulders are weak or you're in the wrong position through the front, you won't be able to extend through the front part of your chest so you can take a good deep breath in. It will affect your ability to rotate. Now, I know a lot of people speak about rotation when you're swimming and when you're running, but it's also important when you're biking, especially when you're having to work that little bit harder and you're really pulling down on the bars. You need that rotation, even more so when you get up and out the saddle. If you don't rotate through the upper part of your back, then the other parts will take the toll, notoriously lower back and pelvis. And that's where you may see the bum sort of swinging side to side. So if you're not strong enough and you're not in a stable position through the shoulders and the neck, it can lead to numerous injuries around the whole body, really.
Okay, so it's not just that it's going to limit our performance on the bike. It's probably going to have an impact on what happens in the run. And I guess that the longer the race that the athlete is doing, the more impact that's going to have in the latter stages. So we know a lot of our listeners are probably going to be racing at 70.3 or even Ironman distance.
Yep.
And you could probably get through the first 10 or 15K of a run.
Yeah.
And that's when everything starts to shut down.
Yep.
And do you think a lot of that is down to the bike position and the work that's done on the bike?
I think it's more down to the actual condition of the rider themselves, the athlete.
The physical condition.
The physical condition. Yes, there's your physical aerobic endurance, but there's also your strength endurance of all the muscles around it, the mobility. So your hips are in a certain position for a long period of time and you're in that position for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. To then get off the bike. So the muscles are going to be fatigued to get off the bike and then start running on fatigued glutes. You know, there's no way on earth they're going to be able to work correctly. And yeah.
So hence we have that thing that people fondly call the Ironman shuffle, where you can no longer pick your knees up.
Yeah.
You're no longer able to use that ankle roll and the sort of like the spring-like effect of the Achilles tendon, and we're really just shuffling along, barely getting the feet off the ground and almost reduced to a walk.
Yeah, very much so. And that's where your calf raises, which are the bane of everybody's life almost, are very important, not just for the running, but more for the cycling. Soleus, the smaller of the two muscles that doesn't cross the knee, that's used more in cycling to prevent your heel going down. So that's constantly being working on the bike. You then need to use that when you get off and run. It's involved in when you hit the ground, stopping your shin bone from coming forwards. It's then involved in pushing you forwards as well. So it is meant to be the most powerful and strongest muscle in the body, yet we see a lot of people that can barely do 3 proper soleus calf raises.
Wow. Poor old soleus. So we've got the glutes now. The glutes are almost challenged for hardest working muscle by the by the soleus now.
Absolutely.
And whoever thinks about the soleus, underrated muscle it is.
Very much so.
So you've... Well, I don't know where to start with all of that then. So that's all right.
Just, throw that in there.
The first thing that you mentioned there was that the aerobic engine is good, but the muscular system is not so good. So you've sort of encapsulated a phrase of mine that it's not the engine that's going to let down these triathletes in the longer races. It's the body work. It's the chassis.
Absolutely.
So it's like having an old car with a fantastic... well-oiled, well-serviced engine and bodywork where the bits are falling off. And as you go along in that race, the wing falls off and then, you know, the suspension goes and you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So we actually, rather than doing more miles on the bike, more yards in the pool or running more, we need to spend more time doing this work and specifically based around the limitations that you've identified. Yep. So, sure, do work for your scapula and for your thoracic spine. But actually, if you've not identified that that's a real weakness, that's not necessarily a priority. It might be that you've identified that the soleus muscle is the priority.
So we tend to, once we've done the report, we'll find everything wrong in Little Miss Perfect, but we will identify the key points today, and then it may be right, and we've got that bit stronger, we can then work on a different area.
So it almost sounds from that we as triathletes, and I mean, because we're doing this podcast for triathletes, but actually I guess that you see endurance athletes from other sports and this particular failing or weakness or lack of prioritization in strength doesn't just affect triathletes, does it?
No, it affects every sport, and every athlete should be doing some kind of rehabilitation, prehabilitation, mobility work so that they can do the sport that they want to do and that they reduce their risk of injury.
So there's probably two parts to this strength and conditioning. There's the prehab for these little exercises that affect the ability of the scapula to stay to be stabilized for long periods of time, despite repeated actions. And then there's what most people would think of strength and conditioning as being able to squat with their own body weight, or being able to deadlift or do 10 pull-ups. That's a different, that's where we're working prime movers rather than stabilizers.
Absolutely.
So if we were going to choose a priority of these, which of those would it be?
It would be the smaller muscles you want to work on. You've got to ask yourself, you know, what is a double leg squat going to do? Nothing.
No.
You're not on two legs on the bike or on the run. So if you can control it in double leg, we want to get you controlling it in single leg because that is much more functional.
I mean, I guess the strength trainers would say that, you know, being able to squat heavily will improve the contractual speed and strength of the muscle fibers. However, if you're not able to stabilize the hips,
yep,
while you're doing that, then that it's a bit like, exactly, that old phrase about firing a cannon from a,
yeah,
canoe.
Yeah.
If the base isn't stable in the first place, then the,
yeah,
the firing power of that muscle,
yeah,
is limited anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. If you can't control that movement, then what's the point?
If this was a court of law now, the judge would,
yes,
say that this is going to be a leading question. But based on what we've just discussed then,
yes,
how much time would you be recommending that a triathlete devotes to this sort of work on a daily or weekly basis?
A daily basis, you want to be thinking about at least 30 to 60 minutes a day.
30 to 60 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. So you know what response that's going,
oh,
to
I
get,
know,
don't you?
I know.
The response, I mean, you've,
yeah,
probably had this, but the response,
yeah,
will be, but I don't have time for that,
yeah,
because I'm swimming, biking and running.
I would say, well, maybe reduce those hours. You're going to get more out of doing your mobility and your strength and conditioning rehabilitation work than you will do spending another 15, 20 minutes on the bike or in the pool. Yeah, it's the important part. It's the bit that all the lead triathletes, they have at least 3 strength and conditioning sessions a week, and they all each have their own personal rehabilitation, prehabilitation program that they do. You then spend, you know, half an hour on an evening doing your foam rollering, your stretching, whatever, just looking after yourself.
This is something that Ian Piper, who's...
yeah,
quite prominent in the strength and conditioning program in Leeds, shared when he was,
yeah,
teaching with me on a British triathlon strength,
okay,
and conditioning course.
Yeah.
He showed that what he called the home conditioning template that he'd,
yeah,
he'd done for Johnny Brownlee.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we won't discuss that here because obviously that's that's sort of pertinent to Johnny only. However, the home conditioning template and was split up into 6 different parts of the body. So I think they had 2 core,
yeah,
ones. One was just the general core area, the,
yeah,
the sort of all of those areas that are around the sort of lower part of the spine. And then there was the other core area, the glutes and,
yeah,
the hips and what have you. Then there was a lower limb.
Yeah.
There was upper back. There was shoulders as well.
Yep.
Yeah, I think maybe there was 5. Anyway, there was 5 or 6.
Right, yeah.
And each of those blocks had maybe 4 or 5 different exercises.
Yep.
And each of those exercises then needed to be repeated for,
yes,
3 sets of 10 to 15 repetitions,
yeah,
with either minimal resistance from something like a TheraBand or just body,
yep,
weight resistance,
yep,
gravity.
Yeah.
But the way Ian had developed this program was that as long as they did these exercises twice a week,
yep,
they could do them any time they like. So you,
yep,
could do them while you're waiting for the kettle to boil, or,
yep,
like you just,
absolutely,
mentioned there, in the evening while you're watching something on telly or listening,
yep,
to some music.
Yep.
It,
yep,
doesn't have to be a specific gym,
no,
session.
No, it doesn't at all.
I mean, I guess some exercises like TheraBand work,
yeah,
you could do before you went swimming.
Yep.
And ankle and lower lamac exercises you could do before or after you've cycled or run.
Yeah, more the swimming, doing the TheraBand before, that's great because that gets everything switched on. There's certain exercises you can do just before you bike and run so that you're switching on the correct muscles. And then things like your calf raises, you would do that afterwards because you don't then want to go and train on an already fatigued,
right,
muscle.
Okay.
So it depends what you're looking for at what particular time you would do it.
So 30 to 60 minutes. I mean, this we talked about this in our pre-conversation, that these,
yeah,
are the things that Dave Brailsford refers to in,
yep,
marginal gains.
Yep, yep.
The commitment required of athletes, and nobody would deny the commitment that the majority of triathletes have in getting,
no,
up early,
oh,
or
no, not at all,
going to their sort of 2 or 3 sessions a day on a regular,
yep,
basis throughout the rubbishy weather we have in the winter.
Yeah.
But if you really want to get the most,
yep,
from your body and from the bike fit that they've invested,
yep,
in, you really,
yeah,
need to do this stuff,
yeah,
not build the engine.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the important stuff, definitely. So,
okay,
cutting down on the time and then more time, spending a bit more time looking after the body will get you much further on the bike than it will spending another 20 minutes busting a gut on the bike.
Now, one of the comments that I often hear from triathletes is that they are unable to reproduce their functional threshold power when they're in the time trial position.
Yep.
Now, is that because the time trial position requires you to do a different test, i.e. that you have a different power, slightly lower, but more aerodynamic? So, or is it because they're just not able to, they're just not comfortable in that position to produce the power?
More likely they're not comfortable to produce that position. For a good aerodynamic position, you need to have a good straight leg raise, which is the length of your hamstrings and the nerves through the back of your leg and lower back. You need to be able to have a good upper body sort of thoracic extension. So we all go, what's the word, thoracic flexion, which is when you're bending forwards over yourself. Extension is the opposite. So you're extending your chest bone up. That needs to be good so that you can breathe correctly. You need to have a good amount of hip flexion, so good mobility within the hips, very good mobility within the hips. But you also need to be very strong through your back and also
lower back.
Yep. And also very strong through your abdominals, your obliques and your general whole core area.
Okay. So if a rider can sit on a road bike.
Yep.
Resting on the hoods.
Yep.
And do a functional threshold test on his indoor trainer. And he can generate 300 watts.
Yeah.
Physiologically, he's capable of generating 300 watts in his time trial position, but he needs to work on that.
He does, and it's also...
She,
whoever that person may be, they also need to be able to train in that position so the body gets used to being that position. So you're using your outer glute strength, which brings us back to the single leg squats that we saw in the part of the assessment. So if you can't use your outer glute, staying in a decent time trial position is going to be very difficult. You're going to be using your quads too much, which is why you'll perform better in a more relaxed angle as in your road bike.
Okay, so investing the time that needs to be invested to get the most out of this bike fit is a lot of gym work.
Yes.
A lot of what the swimmers are called dry land work.
Yeah.
We're not talking about riding the bike here. Nope. However... we also have to ride the bike and we have to ride for extended periods at that power that we wish to be comfortable at.
Yes, absolutely.
And I guess if what happens is if the rider isn't comfortable at generating that power or doing it for prolonged periods of time, at some point in the bike section of that race, they're going to be changing, wriggling around, uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
They're going to be sitting up on the hood, so they're then in a less aerodynamic position.
Yep.
And that bike that they've invested in, which was the most aero bike in the winter, and the reason they spent £5,000 on it, and now becomes the least aerodynamic bike because of what's perched on top of it.
Absolutely. They can't hold that position. So you need to train in the position you want to race in. And that then incorporates all the prehabilitation work and maintaining the power that you can tolerate in that position in your power tests.
Okay. Now, obviously, when we get to T2, we're going to have to run.
Yes.
So how much of your setting up the bike is a compromise?
Yep.
So if you were setting up a bike for a time trialist who was only going to have to sit on the bike and not do any running, how much differently would you set up a triathlon bike?
The angles on triathlon bikes are usually slightly more relaxed than they are on a specific TT bike, one because of that reason. I pay a little bit of attention to it, but then I sort of work much more on the body. It should be the body's capability to work in that position, have the mobility around the hip to go from being in a quite an aero position to then coming and standing upright. And there's a couple of things you can do towards the end of the bike and even in T2. You know, you're taking a bit of time to get changed. Just have a couple of quick stretches through the hips and pelvis. So I pay a bit of attention about what they're going to be doing in terms of going from biking to running. But that more comes down to the actual body and also how they ride as well. what muscles they're using. If they're much more of a tower, they're going to be using their quads and calves. If they're able to keep the heel further down a little bit, you're going to be utilizing the glutes, which will take a bit of the pressure off your hip flexors. So I also look at how they ride and then give them specific drills that they could do on the bike themselves to help that.
You mentioned breathing earlier on. So you and I have probably been to races where we see people who've adopted these extreme positions.
Yep.
Partly because it probably looks cool if you're really low at the front. I see some bikes that people have taken photographs of, and the saddle seems to be sort of sometimes 6 inches above the armrest. And thinking, well, that looks really extreme, but I wonder what they're like when they run off that. Most people I know don't pay any attention to breathing because it's just something that they do automatically. But I know when you did my assessment, you said that part of my diaphragm was stuck to my liver.
Yeah.
How do things like that happen in the first place?
Could be from an accident or an injury or a surgery that you've had in that area. They could be you've just adopted an altered breathing pattern. This day and world, it's all about stress, racing about. People don't breathe correctly. They tend to breathe more up into their chest. We're both just sitting up right here now. you know, they breathe into their upper chest. Lungs are like a triangle. They're only using the small part of the triangle if it is into the upper chest. So if you're unable to expand down through the diaphragm, you're not able to use the larger part of your lungs. So often it is because of what you do in the day that will then have an effect how you go on the bike. So you've got the poor movement pattern from what you do in the day. You then get yourself in a very aero position where your elbows are really closed round close to you, and it's game over in terms of breathing.
So are you suggesting then that perhaps cyclists and triathletes need to spend a little bit of time just sitting and actually working on some basic breathing drills as
Definitely.
Well?
Breathing is one of the biggest things we teach at the clinic, how to breathe correctly, regardless of their age, fitness level, sport that they do. Breathing is the biggest thing. And a breathing pattern disorder gives so many different issues as well.
How much do you think it could limit somebody's performance if after being in an aero position for 3, 4, 6 hours, they're then unable to use their lungs and their breathing properly?
I don't know, but I would just imagine considerable amount, because if you're only using, say, 30-40% of your lung capacity that you could use, then, you know, that's about 50% performance-wise. If you're not using your lungs correctly, then you're not able to get the oxygen in to your muscles. You're not then able to get the carbon dioxide back out. So you will get that increased fatigue, that increased buildup within the muscles themselves.
I can always remember watching Miguel Indurain. Do you remember him?
Yes.
And thinking, God, he looks fat. But what it was when he was in that time trial position,
you could
see him breathing. And it was his lungs expanding, pushing his diaphragm down and expanding into his stomach. And I mean, they did say that he had huge lungs. So I guess that was him having practiced that breathing pattern to maximise his.
Yeah.
And that was when he was in that time trial position as well. And, you know, he was a phenomenal time trialist.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
Ribs coming out laterally, diaphragm dropping down the way. So, yeah, just to maximise its size.
I mean, aside from triathlon performance, I guess if you are breathing more efficiently and effectively in your everyday life, that's going to have impact on your energy levels and on your general health and human performance during the day.
Absolutely, yeah. Your brain fatigue, everything like that can make you feel a bit brain foggy, can give you all sorts of weird and wonderful symptoms, but definitely energy.
It did just occur to me that whilst we're in this cramped over position on our aero bars, particularly the longer the race goes on, we have to take in nutrition.
Yes.
Is bike position going to have a major impact on ability to digest foods? And do you make any dispensation for that when you're setting the bike up?
It will do. And yes, ideally, that's where, you know, being in the best aero position may not be quite so good for you, because you have to take in food and you've got to be able to digest it. And again, the breathing will have an effect on that. If the diaphragm's up, that will push the stomach up that little bit further. So it's going to sit there. But yes, being in that position is not good for the digestion. And that's where the trial and error in racing and training comes in before you do your key race.
Okay, so it's summarising this conversation, and it strikes me that what we're looking for in a bike position that we're going to practice riding in and spending time preparing to ride in by strengthening up our body to be able to accommodate that. It strikes me that we are going to find a position which is a compromise.
Yes.
An immediate look at somebody on a bike might indicate to somebody that actually that doesn't look like the most aerodynamic position, but we're not considering the time just on the bike. We're considering the whole performance, because triathlon isn't three sports, it's one sport with three disciplines. And we need to consider the impact that this position is going to have on the run as well.
Very much so.
So it may not be the most aerodynamic position, but if it allows the athlete to breathe better, to be more relaxed in the shoulders and upper body, and to digest the nutrition, then they're going to be better off on the run.
Absolutely.
And they're not going to lose that time they gained.
Nope.
Later on.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll lose more time by being in an aero-compact position than you will do by being a slightly more relaxed position, but you're able to eat, drink and breathe. So you've got the energy to then get you through to the end of the race.
Okay. Well, there's a lot to be thinking about there. Probably a bit of an eye-opener for some of our listeners to know that 30 to 60 minutes a day, what I would say, Louisa, is that your statement there has probably confirmed what some of our previous guests, Robin Brew, the swim coach, and Sarah Pitts, the mobility specialist, have both said that in order to be better performers, Sarah as a talking about a performer overall, Robin clearly talking about a swimmer, to be better performers, the athlete really needs to be devoting more time to the way the body works rather than more time in training the aerobic system. And you seem to be speaking along the same lines.
Oh, very much so. And I know you have other life things, a full-time job, kids, family, all that kind of stuff, but you will get more out of designating, you know, even 20, 30 minutes as a bare minimum a day to your mobility and your rehabilitation than spending another 20 minutes in the pool or on the bike.
I suppose one of the final things I'd wrap up with is that I would guess that the majority, if not all, of the listeners are people who participate in triathlon as a hobby.
Yes.
So they have other things that are actually a priority in their life.
Absolutely.
And actually, the things you talked about there, breathing, digestion, ability to move freely without aches or pains, affect the whole of human life, not just your ability to perform as an athlete. And for me, that is the most important thing, is your ability to perform as a human.
Yeah.
So even if we don't do this with a view to being a faster triathlete, being a better performing human would be a good reason for more mobility, better breathing.
Yeah, you have more energy, so you can spend more, you're not feeling quite so tired, to spend time with your kids, and you'll be able to, you know, work better, everything better, really.
So, listeners, there you have it. The end of two very, very informative podcasts, starting off with bike fit and the way in which the White Witch Louisa Edmondson performs those, and finishing with a discussion about movement, mobility, compromise, and the amount of effort that you need to put in, not just on the bike, but off the bike, in order to get the most from your optimal bike position. I hope that you found it useful. I certainly have. I learned something every single time I speak with one of our one of our expert guests, and I've learned a lot today that I'll be putting into practice. So I hope you do too. If you want to get hold of Louisa to experience the benefit of her white witchery, you can find, in fact, I'll let Louisa tell you, where can they find you, Louisa?
They can find me at the Coach House CSPC Physiotherapy Clinic, which is up in West Park, Headingley, Leeds.
And while you're there, you may bump into one of those high performance triathletes.
You may well do.
Louisa mentioned. They're always coming in and out of there to do their prehab work and to get treated for the various injuries they pick up. There's a great coffee shop over the road where you can
go
and wait.
There is, yes. Yep.
And as I say, I thoroughly recommend you make an appointment to see Louisa if you're in the market for a bike fit coming up very soon. So today, thank you very much, listeners. Thank you very much, Louisa, for coming over here in this incredible weather to be my guest today.
Thank you for having me, Simon. It's been fab, actually. Good fun.
Okay. In the show notes, there will be details on phone numbers and websites and email addresses for the Coach House, so you can contact them if you do want to make an appointment. So from me, Simon Ward, from
Louisa,
thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back again soon with another fabulous guest. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.
That wraps up this week's episode. I'd just like to say thank you for taking the time to listen to the conversation today, and I hope you learned at least one thing that you can put into practice in your training. Now, if this was your first time listening, please go back and listen to our previous episodes. I can guarantee that they will be just as good as you heard from today's guest. If you've listened to all the episodes so far, then thank you so much for continuing this learning journey with me. As you might be aware, reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so I would really appreciate it if you could leave a review and a rating on iTunes or Podbean. You could also follow me at the same time. I also have a free gift for you. In 30 years of competing in triathlon and 20 years of coaching, I've learned an awful lot from my own experiences and from some of the guests who have and will appear on this show. And I feel it's my duty, as I approach the latter stage of my coaching career, to share these with you. So I've put together 25 of my best training, racing and lifestyle strategies, and I've squeezed them down into just 2 pages of content. And in order to get hold of this, all you need to do is email triathlonsuccess@thetriathloncoach.com, and she will send it right back out to you. You could also think about joining my Facebook community. It's called the Triathlon Coach Cafe. We've got over 2,300 members just like you, eager to find out more about how to improve their training and share their successes with people. It's free to join, but you will have to ask. So go along there, answer the questions, and then we'll even do a little video each week to answer your questions. Finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe using Podbean or iTunes. We release new episodes every Wednesday. So that's all for now. See you again next week, same time, same place.